This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection has reached a settlement with three environmental groups that had challenged its handling of the embattled Mariner East 2 pipeline. State Impact's Marie Cusick has more.
The DEP will pay more than $27,000 to the groups, and it has agreed to work to enhance public participation around pipelines. The agency will post more information online and convene a new stakeholder group to weigh in on pipeline-related issues. Maya Van Rossum heads the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, one of the groups that's part of the agreement.
So while this doesn't cure the violations that have already taken place with regards to the Sunoco Mariner East pipeline project, it really puts in place critical protection for future projects.
The pipeline is planned to carry natural gas liquids from western Pennsylvania to an export terminal near Philadelphia. It has faced numerous problems throughout its construction, including spills, sinkholes, and legal disputes like this one. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
Cicadas have been doing some strange things, like moving around and mating despite having up to a third of their bodies missing. Researchers suspect that fungi are involved. Several scientists at West Virginia University took advantage of the 17-year cicadas that emerged about 2 years ago to dig a little deeper. So they investigated the relationship between cicadas and certain kinds of fungi by looking very closely at what kinds of compounds are in the fungus. Matt Cawson and Greg Boyce were involved in the research and spoke with news director Jesse Wright about a very surprising study they published last week.
So thanks both for joining me. I appreciate you coming on the show. So Matt, can you describe the work that you just had published?
Yeah, so we were looking at interactions between an obligate pathogen of cicadas interaction with the host. And what we found was something remarkable. These fungi, in their interaction with cicadas, are producing psychotropic alkaloids that are modifying the behavior of the cicadas to benefit the fungus. And this includes the first discovery of amphetamine production across all fungi that are known, and what appears to be an independent evolution of psilocybin production in kingdom fungi outside the magic mushroom group of fungi that are known to produce that compound.
So this is the brood that everybody is probably aware of, was very hyped. They spent, 16 years and 10, 11 months underground feeding, and then they emerge. Beady red eyes, quite large. So they are infected by this fungus. Can you tell me a little bit about the effects of this relationship between the host and the parasite?
Sure. There's been a lot of work done recently on the interactions between fungi and their insect hosts. Sometimes it's not a real easy thing to tease apart because these fungi happen to be obligate parasites, which means we can't culture them in the lab. We can't grow them and study them alone. We have to study them while they're interacting with their host. And we know a subset of cicadas that emerge as part of these giant broods that come out every 13 or 17 years become infected. So there's some atypical behaviors associated with these fungal infections. For example, these cicadas exhibit conspicuous infections on the backside of their bodies. Their abdomen completely falls off, revealing a kind of continuous fungal plug. Yet the cicadas seem unaware that this is going on, even though a third of their body may have fallen off, including their genitalia. They don't seem to be aware of it and continue to engage in typical feeding and mating behaviors like those healthy cicadas in and around them. But they also seem to have kind of a increased pep in their step, if I can characterize it in that way. And that's what really drew us to this question of what was driving that behavior. We noticed that cicadas, even though they had these debilitating infections, were engaging socially and sexually with partners a lot more than you would expect for someone or something that had lost a third to half their body.
Can you talk a little bit about how you got at these compounds? You know, one thing that struck me in your study is these is identifying these compounds that we associate with almost recreational drugs at this point, amphetamines and psilocybin, although they can be naturally derived. But you found these compounds in places where you wouldn't normally find them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the way that we found, identified, and discovered these compounds specifically was by taking the fungal plugs that were on the abdomen of the infected cicadas and doing an extraction of all of the small molecule type of what we call metabolites found produced by these fungi. And using a technique called mass spectrometry, which is a very accurate and very sensitive way of detecting and identifying these small molecule metabolites, and we searched them against the known database of metabolites of all living things. And from there, we identified, detected, and quantified the amount of psilocybin and the amphetamine that was present in the fungal plug.
So if I get this right, in a sense, the fungus is almost providing a function to its host that the fungus can't provide on its own.
Correct.
It's like driving a car. You need to go somewhere. You need to go to the grocery store. It uses the cicada is the fungus is the car of the fungi, and it uses these psychotropic chemicals to kind of induce movement because the fungi itself is not motile.
Parasites are really good at this. They're really good at finding the most efficient vehicle for dissemination, and for Mesospora, cicadas through chemical modification seem to be the answer.
So what do you see as the implications of the work that you've done, and what do you hope other scientists do with this study?
So I think what our study really shows is that, you know, there's a lot of really interesting interactions hidden in plain sight. We often walk by these small insects that are succumbing to fungal infections, or not succumbing in the case of Mesospora and cicadas. But what we're starting to understand is that there's a lot happening beneath the surface metabolically, and these compounds have great utility in medicine and in culture. And I think what we'll find is that over the next decade, the fields of metabolomics will help unlock some of these compounds, some of which are likely to be novel and could change the face of medicine.
What I would like to see happen with the future work involving this study is to explore the relationship between fungi and their symbiotic or parasitic partners and get a better understanding of the metabolic capacity of these organisms and how humans can exploit that capacity to better themselves through pharmaceuticals or therapeutics out of these complex small molecule metabolites.
I think one thing we should probably caution the listener is it might be tempting to go out and find cicadas and eat them. But, you know, we're talking about two or three metabolites that we've reported on. This study uncovered hundreds, if not thousands, of metabolites, some of which we don't understand their function inside vertebrates. We don't understand their function inside invertebrates. So it's possible there could be some real lethal metabolites in some of these fungus-infected cicadas. So just a kind of a cautionary tale there.
Well, I certainly will look at cicadas and probably all insects in a different way from here on out. So I really appreciate you both taking the time. Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That was Matt Cawson, Assistant Professor of Plant Pathology at WVU, and Gregory Boyce, a postdoctoral researcher, speaking with Jesse Wright. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:53. Mostly cloudy skies today. Scattered rain and thunderstorms. High temperatures in the 80s. Slight chance of rain and thunderstorms tonight with lows in the 60s. Mostly cloudy skies on Tuesday with a chance of rain and thunderstorms. Highs in the 70s and 80s. And more rain and thunderstorms tomorrow night and Wednesday. Lows tomorrow night in the 50s and 60s. Highs tomorrow in the 70s and 80s. Support for the weather forecast is provided by Erie Insurance, putting service first since 1925. Local agents available at erieinsurance.com. The number of cases of hepatitis A continues to grow in the Ohio Valley. Health officials across the region are scrambling to slow the spread of what they call an unusual outbreak. Those most affected are often homeless, poor, or struggling with addiction. Reporter Mary Meehan explains how the region's income inequality is fueling the spread of this infectious disease.
Jim Thacker is frustrated. The spokesperson for the Madison County, Kentucky Health Department says there is a real threat of a hepatitis A outbreak at the detention center right down the road in Richmond. Built to house about 240 inmates, it now holds more than 400.
It's sort of like a petri dish because it is so tightly packed.
Other communities have vaccinated inmates, and Kentucky health officials have supplied vaccine to prisons. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention supplies free vaccine for use in high-risk groups. Currently, that is primarily homeless people and people with substance use disorders. Thacker says that deal comes with a hitch.
The benchmark set by the state and the CDC is that if a county has five cases of Hep A, then they immediately become eligible for 1,000 doses of hepatitis A vaccine.
With only one confirmed case so far, Madison County hasn't met that threshold. Thacker has only a few dozen doses of vaccine available, and only for people in the high-risk groups.
We would like to get the 1,000 doses before we reach five cases. And are making inquiries about whether or not we can actually do that because we'd like to get ahead of the game.
Requests for more vaccine are being reviewed on a case-by-case basis. In the meantime, hepatitis A is spreading rapidly. 300 cases were reported during June in West Virginia. Dr. Ahul Gupta is the chief health officer in West Virginia. He says comprehensive harm reduction efforts, which include needle exchange programs, testing, and referrals, are essential to reaching those populations most at risk.
I think it's critically important because that's an area and that's a place where you're seeing these high-risk individuals. And the ability to offer that can often be the difference between having an outbreak in your community and not having an outbreak in your community.
Dr. Jeffrey Howard is Kentucky's public health commissioner. Howard grew up poor in Harlan, and he knows the challenges of poverty. He says this infectious disease outbreak just highlights the chronic problems of much of Appalachia.
Considering we're trying to focus our effort on what we call social determinants of health, which aren't just social issues. They're, you know, can you get to care? Do you got a car? Do you got a cell phone? Can you fill your prescriptions? Can you do all the things you need to do in order to be healthy?
Vonda Wyporska is executive director of the Equality Trust based in London. Her organization researches the social impact of inequality.
What we're seeing is an increased amount of money going to the top 1%.
That leaves fewer resources for the middle class and the working poor, and can set the stage for an infectious disease outbreak like Hep A.
In these countries where there are higher levels of inequality, you are going to have more of these problems. And this looks as if it's been typified by the outbreak that you're talking about.
Disease, in turn, makes it harder for those living on the margin to stay solvent. She says if you're working at an hourly minimum wage job, missing work or spending time in the hospital can set up a cascade of misery.
One very small step, sometimes quite a minor step, for people to fall into that spiral.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan in Richmond, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.